Well, I think if I were doing kids' church today, and you'll see why in a few minutes, this would be a challenging lesson to teach. If you don't know, we're going through the story, and this is a 31-week journey through the Bible. The book that we have is basically giving a summary of different things and picking out different parts to help us see the seaming of the Bible all the way through. There are parts, as you read the story, there are parts of exact quotes from the Bible, and then there's some summary passages as well. And so when we look at different things, sometimes we look and we say, okay, this is really awesome. And when I was growing up, we had this thing called flannel graph. Anybody know what flannel graph is? Anybody not know what flannel graph is? That shows age. And okay, so you didn't go to Sunday school when I did. So here's what flannel graph is. Flannel graph is this thing where they put on flannel, this other character or something to be able to, it's like modern day, it's PowerPoint, but going back before we had technology is kind of what it is. And you'd put Moses up there and different things. And when we would go through the Bible in Sunday school or kids' church, when I was growing up, some of the things that I never saw were some of the tragedies and difficulties. Like, for example, when the flood happened, they never showed a picture of the boat on the water with a whole bunch of bodies. That would be scary for kids, yes? Today is going to be an interesting one. This would probably match or get better than, or worse than, would be more appropriately said, a Jerry Springer show. So just to kind of give you some balance of this, and we're in chapter 12, Trials of the King. And so I'm going to look at three different trials of the king. Now, let me review. Last week we looked at the main theme of last week is God chooses anyone to do anything in his time. Have you thought about that this week? That God puts you in situations, and all of us in situations, where he chooses anyone, I'm an anyone, you're an anyone, to do anything, whatever he chooses in his time. So the timing of whatever is going on in our life is specifically rooted in what God wants for us, and he puts us into that, and it's, okay, this is your thing, God. So God chooses anyone to do anything in his time. The summary, as we came down to it, is our responsibility simply is to be available to God. That's, in summary, what our responsibility is. It's to be available to God. So my question is, how did you do this week? So many of you marked off on your response card, I want to make myself more available to God. So how'd you do this week? Were you more available to God this week than last week? I don't know. What do you mean by that? Well, we're going to work through that. As we are looking at Christmas time, last week we looked at giving gifts and how exciting it is to get exactly what you want. And so I found another video that I thought would help to illustrate this message this morning. And so let me go ahead and watch this.
Okay, so what are you guys doing? Are you opening a present before Christmas?
Yeah! Open it, and we're both going to play.
Yeah, because there's only one.
Are you excited?
So
yeah.
You have to be fair about right. it, because remember, the one that gets to open it, the other one gets to use it first.
Rocky,
all right, let's open it.
So make sure you're fair.
Rocky, open it.
So you get to open it, she gets to use it first.
Open it.
Come on. Hurry. Don't worry about ripping the paper. Come on.
No, wait.
Keep going.
Okay, now you should open the box. Yep, you can open it.
Other side.
The anticipation builds and builds.
First.
I'm not using it.
Merry Christmas.
We don't like toilet paper.
Merry Christmas.
You guys like your gift?
No.
Can I see it?
No. It's gone.
it?
No, Daddy got it. I mean, Olivia's using it.
No, you're using it.
Oh, well, the deal was...
Stop throwing it.
The deal was that Rocky opened it and Olivia used it first.
I thought it was a toy box!
What did you think was in there?
Star figures.
Why did you even get it, though? You didn't want it.
What?
So that you might appreciate what you get for Christmas. Because if it's anything other than toilet paper, you should be very happy at home.
I don't like the toilet paper.
Can you stop?
It's not funny.
Oh, gosh. I'm crying. I need some of the toilet paper.
Merry Christmas, Mom.
Merry Christmas.
Hey, we can play with it.
Isn't that great? See, I dismissed the kids first because now you all have an idea for this season of, oh, I'm getting toilet paper for my child. I can't wait. Toilet paper. Now, in some countries, if you got the gift of toilet paper, that'd be a wonderful thing, okay? In our country, not so good. My question. As I was thinking about this, how many times do we give God toilet paper? We only have just a little bit of time available. I mean, that's all. My availability to you, God, I know you're supposed to be my first place. I know that, God, but I've got a little bit of time I'm going to give you and finances, well, here's what I've left over after I've gotten all my presents and all my bills and all this. And you can have this part of my heart, but not all of it. It looks, all of that looks like giving God toilet paper. And how often is it that when we give God toilet paper, that we say, look what I gave you, God. I've given you so much. Have you thought about the comparison of what God's given to us? Did God give us toilet paper? What was his gift to us? His son. Is there anything more precious? Anything more valuable? Now, I know. Starting out a message like that, I'll have some of you ready to throw toilet paper at me and say, I didn't come here for a guilt trip. I came for you to cheer me up and make my life a little bit better. And you're starting out with a guilt trip. I'm tuning you out right away. And often, see, here's the problem that's associated with that. I'm bringing this to our attention. And oftentimes what happens is you'll translate and say, well, all he's now talking about is the church hour. Oh, here's the thing. He's trying to get us to give more money. Oh, he's trying to have us show up more often to church, or he's getting volunteers for this ministry. And there's an ulterior motive that's associated with me saying that about what we are doing as a church. And can I just pull back and say, that is only 1 hour or 2 hours out of the, 168 hours in the week? My concern is not for the hour and a half that we're here. My concern is that we are giving God toilet paper in our relationships, in our homes, in our community, instead of giving God what he wants, what is best. Before you tune out, I want you to hear from the picture that we have in David's life. Last week, we talked about David, and we end up with David as, like, he's the best. He's the next king. He is picked by God. He is chosen. He is that one to do this amazing thing to be the king in this specific time. It's an amazing thing. And he passes these tests after test after test. But today, I want to kind of flip that story over and show you three trials of the king. Three difficult times that he went through and show you some failure around his life. And by doing this, I believe we can see sometimes when we observe mistakes, when we observe things that don't go right, we're able to glean that much more. One of the phrases that I've heard about leadership, management and things, a person that learns from their mistakes and doesn't repeat them is the one that's your best manager, your best leader. And I'll just say, as we look at this, to look at mistakes and look at where we are, and can I ask you to be honest enough with yourself? Don't look at the person next to you. The temptation is going to be there. It honestly will today. The temptation is going to be to look at the person next to you and say, yep, they're the toilet paper gifter. I know they are. You're not a re-gifter. You're a toilet paper gifter. That's what you are. And that will be the temptation. I'm going to look down the pew. I'm going to nudge the person next to me in my mind and say, I hope they're paying attention to this point because pastor's got them nailed. Can I just pull back and say, just be transparent and honest with yourself and look at where you really are as to whether you are a toilet paper gifter. As I studied through this message, my tendency kept being to look at someone else constantly. And I had to keep on going back and say, okay, God, I don't want to be a toilet paper gifter. I want to be who you want me to be. So I'm going to warn you as we dive in here. So if you have your Bibles, open them to 2 Samuel chapter 6. 2 Samuel chapter 6. I thought about handing out toilet paper today so that you could take that home with you, but I didn't think you needed that. That would be ammunition at some point in the message maybe, or you'd give it to someone and it might not turn out so well. So I figure you all have toilet paper at home. So when you use toilet paper, probably all of you will use toilet paper today. So as you use toilet paper, I want you to think about this. Don't be a toilet paper gifter to God. Fair enough? Okay. 2 Samuel chapter 6, we're going to look at three trials that David goes through, and here's trial number one. Let me explain the story of what's going on. The story, the background is the Ark of the Covenant, David wants to bring into his town where he's at, into this main place, and that's the desire. And so as he's bringing it in, some things happen with that, and he's not able to bring it in right away, and it takes us some time to be able to bring the Ark of the Covenant back. And the Ark of the Covenant, if you don't know anything about that, and you're like, well, isn't that Indiana Jones thing? Yes, it is. But this is a special thing that Israel had as a representation of the presence of God. And so it had several different things inside of it, and it was just an ornate and beautiful thing for the children of Israel. It carried with it blessings and cursings, actually, that you'd follow around and do some historical work with it. Where is the Ark of the Covenant today? There's a lot of theological and historical arguments as to where this is. Some would say it's in heaven, actually. Some would say it's hidden somewhere, and we're not sure. So I'm not going to dive into that. I'm not Indiana Jones, and I'm not going to pretend to be. I think the hat would look good on me, and the whip would be really cool to carry around, but I'm going to pass. So here in 2 Samuel chapter 6, as we look at the passage, now the Ark of the Covenant is brought into David's presence, into David's kingdom, into the worship center there that he has for it. And so as it comes in, verse 12, I'm just going to pick it up in the middle here and just for sake of time not read the whole passage, but it says, and it was told to King David, the Lord has blessed the kingdom of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the Ark of God. So David went and brought the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom, which was there for 3 months, to the city of David with rejoicing. And when those who bore the Ark of the Covenant had gone 6 steps, they sacrificed an ox and fattened animal. And David danced before the Lord with all his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. We don't have those. If you go to Kohl's or Walmart, you can't find a linen ephod. But it's some kind of skirt, boxers, something. I don't know. Kilt. Okay. So we'll move on. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Covenant, or Ark of the Lord, with shouting and with the sound of the horn. So this is a celebration time. What's David doing? I know, we're in a Baptist church. You can't even say this word in a Baptist church. He was doing what? He was dancing. Okay, so and if you think dancing is sinful, we'll work on that. But here in the text, you find David dancing, which is to jump up and down, whirl around, not a sensual dance, but this is a celebratory dance. This is like a touchdown kind of a... Okay, so verse 16, and the ark of the Lord came into the city of David. Michal, the daughter of Saul, Saul being the king, this was the trophy wife, in a sense, or trophy that he got, received for killing Goliath. Okay, good, you're with me. So here's the Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord. And how does she respond to this? She despised him in his heart. She despised him. Now, this is interesting. It's the same word that is used in 1 Samuel chapter 17 when Goliath talked about David. He said he despised him. It's fascinating, the correlation here, that you find Goliath and his wife now are looking at him and saying, we don't like you so much. And so she despised him in her heart. And they brought in the Ark of the Covenant and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And when David had finished offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts and distributed among all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both men and women, a cake of bread, a portion of meat, and a cake of raisin to each one. Then all the people departed, each to his house. And David returned to bless his household. But Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David. He's coming to his place. There's still a lot of people around. This would be family, close friends, and such. She comes out to meet him, and she says, how the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, and one of the vulgar fellows, shamelessly uncovers himself. Good thing to say to your husband that's the king, or bad thing? You looked so stupid and vulgar and messed up. I can't believe you, David. I was so embarrassed. And maybe this provoked her insecurities. Maybe it provoked her fears. Maybe she was jealous because she wanted to be there with him and she wanted to be, I don't know. But here's what we know. She turns against him and then says, you looked like the fool. David's response. David said to Michal, it was before the Lord who chose me. Now, this is an interesting thing. You might never do this in your relationship, in your husband and wife, but let me just tell you, this is a bad thing to do, okay? It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, and I will make merry before the Lord. Now, stop there. Who's he picking on first? The in-laws, yes? It's usually not good to say, you know what, you're just like your mother. You're just like your father. It's usually not a good thing to do. And if you go there, okay, so we'll just move on. That's what David does. It's fascinating. And he says, I will make merry before the Lord. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will abase in your eyes but the female servants of whom you've spoken, but by them I shall be held in honor. Here's what she's saying. You're giving God toilet paper. You're not even giving God toilet paper, but what you're doing is looking like toilet paper. And here's what David says. This isn't toilet paper. I will go even more to humiliate myself to give God more praise. I'll do whatever it takes because God is king and I want everyone to know it. So we have a marital dispute going on here with the king and his wife. Within this, let me give some application. Because in verse 23, it's fascinating what happens. Verse 23 is there's a debatable topic here that I'm not really going to dive into, but I'll give you both sides of this, and you can choose. In verse 23, and afterwards, I'm sure a few of you will come up and say, here's what I think, and that's awesome. Verse 23, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. Here's what we see. Michal comes and condemns or criticizes or whatever with the king and says this about him, judges him wrong. From this point forward, and she never has children. Now, some will say that this was God closing her womb and not allowing her to have a child. Others will say they never performed the marital act in order to have children. There's two sides. Either way, she did not have children, whether it was because of a marital issue or because God closed. We'll leave that alone for right now. Either way, it caused problems. Bottom line. Proverbs. Let me give application to both husbands and wives. Because this time of year is actually the hardest time of year for marriages. Because there's so many expectations that are unfulfilled. There's so many struggles that go on and such. Wives, don't be like Michal. Here's what Michal did. Michal would be one that you'd refer to in the book of Proverbs, where several times, six or seven times, it mentions the contentious woman. The contentious woman is the one who contends with. She's contending with, she's making an argument with, she's pushing the buttons of her husband. Where Solomon and David and the others, they actually refer to this contentious woman, and it says, you'd be better to go out into the desert and just keep walking than to live with her. Do you follow me? It would be better to live on the housetop in the up in the attic somewhere where she can't find you than to live with her. Here's what a contentious woman does. A contentious woman, and I'll say this is who Michal was, in order to get to the point of being angry with him to this degree and making it a public kind of issue, not fully public, but enough, this would have had to be some kind of a pattern. That's my assertion into the text. Now, as we look at being a contentious woman, I'll say, what that means is it's kind of like, illustrate, doing the waterboard torture to your husband. Basically, you're going to keep nagging and nagging and nagging and pressing and pushing and convincing and arguing and contending until he breaks, until you get your way. Children are good at this too, yes? Where it's, I'm going to keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing until they break and I get my way. That is what Proverbs and such is talking about, the contentious woman. That's opposite from what Peter describes as a godly woman who Peter says, will win her husband without a word, but by her chaste, by her behavior that is honorable, by what's going on inside the hidden person of the heart, she will win her husband without even a word. And it describes Abraham and Sarah, where Sarah was put in a tough position a couple of times, not a little bit tough, but very tough, where she's put in a tough position, and she responds by saying, okay. Can I just say, especially at this time, if you're pounding to get your way, guess where he'll end up? There's this new thing that we have as a popular thing today. It's called a man cave. I believe a man cave, in many respects, I'm not condemning it. I'm not saying it's totally wrong. But I think in many respects, it's basically, I'm going to flee away from dealing with my issues over here so I can hide for a while. Now, I know some of you have a man cave and you're like, oh man, Pastor, why you got to go there? And now I got to deal with that on my way home. She's going to ask me if I'm contentious and I got to answer that. And it's like, you know, does this stress make me look fat? I don't want to answer that one either. I know. So I'm not saying always. In your case, probably it's a special room that she said, this is wonderful. I'd love to have you away from. I mean, I would love for this to be a blessing for you. I don't know. Here's my point. My point is, here's Michal. And here's what the Bible talks about as a wife. Don't be a contentious wife. Don't be a contentious wife. Don't be beating him down till you get your way. Children, make sure you're not raising up children that beat you down to get your way. You're working at doing things the right way. Now, David's response, and I'm not sure that this is a good response either. Here's what David does. David basically pushes her away, attacks the in-laws, and goes on attack to her. I don't know that I would agree with that either, but this is how the story unfolds, and that's what we get. Peter warns in the same passage a little bit further in the New Testament. Peter warns husbands of being bitter against your wives. Here's the other side of the story. Maybe your wife pushes you. Maybe she's contentious, quote unquote, or not quite contentious, but sometimes she can be. Maybe that's what's going on in your, I don't know. But as you go through that, you have a way to respond to this. You can respond by being bitter towards your wife and angry and irritable all the time. And here's what a bitter husband does. He feeds her vinegar or feeds her something that's really bitter all the time and says, this is a gift. It's like, I'm giving you toilet paper all the time, and you should be happy that I've given you toilet paper. Now, wives, please, this is not the time to nudge your husband and say he's talking to you. You follow me? Okay? And husbands, by the way, you shouldn't be nudging your wife either. We good now? Here's the reality. David could have said, honey, you're wrong here. There could have been an escape here that was altogether different than the way this worked itself out. That's the reality. Maybe she was angry. Maybe she was insecure. I don't know. But maybe it could have been different. The reality is there's pride versus humility. Here's the trial, pride versus humility. One or both of them were filled with pride at some point. Michael, for sure, was filled with pride in that she caused a contention, a problem that then affected her for the rest of her life. The evidence, and here's what I'm trying to press in on. Do you have a proud home? Or do you have a humble home? Do you have a proud home or a humble home? Whether you're struggling with bitterness or contention, it all boils back to pride versus humility. A proud home looks like this. It's constant contention and criticism. It's always nitpicking and always getting on. It's really inciting and causing arguments all the time. That's a contentious home. It's filled with criticism. It's a proud home. The evidence of a humble home is consistent grace. It is opposite. It's consistent grace. I'm pouring out my grace to you. Yup, you made a mistake. And instead of, you know, Michael getting irritated with him having his display, she just looks and says, okay. David, that was different. Can you explain what was going on to me? Just, I'm really struggling with this. He says, I was worshiping the Lord. I think the ladies might have been looking at you like you're foolish. I don't know. It's working it out. It's having grace. And then him responding and saying, no. I don't care what I look like. I want to worship God. Okay. And it's leading each other to God. It's an act of grace. How often is it that when you see a flaw in each other, you pick it out and you show each other and you say, oh, look, I got a microscope and I'm honing in on your flaw again and again and again. A proud home is constantly looking at flaws and looking at what you've done wrong. A humble home is opposite. It's pouring out grace. It's that when you see a flaw that you need to mention and bring up, you're bringing up in a way to bring restoration and reconciliation. That's grace. It's not that you never say anything. That's just simply backing away and saying, well, I'll just go to my man cave now or my woman cave, whatever it is. Instead, it's I'm going to give you truth, but we're going to work through this in order to bring reconciliation and growth. What I see in this marriage is reconciliation did not occur after that. That's the point. So there's trial number one. Humility makes you available to God then because you see things from God's perspective and you act graciously toward others. I'm more available to God. I'm acting graciously. Here's number two. Go to 2 Samuel chapter 11. Let me take some pressure off the ladies now and I'm going to focus in on the men because I think I hit the ladies pretty good on the first one. You can think about that a little bit. Okay, you know, 2 Samuel chapter 11. In chapter 11, verse 1, Here we fast forward a little bit, and in the spring, it says, of the year, the time when kings go out to battle. Now stop there. Let me give you some context. During the wintertime, did they go out to battle? No. What they would do is they would kind of rest and recoup and train and do different things. And why would you go at the wintertime anyway? Because you just freeze. And history would show that as well. And so in the springtime, they would, things would come back to life and like, okay, it's time to fight. So we're going out, and all the kings go out to battle. It's kind of an interesting thing. And so they go out to battle. And it says, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. Here's the reality. David was supposed to, as the king, go out to battle with them. His place, where he should be, is out in the battle. But instead, what he did was he stayed back home to do nothing, to relax and to take it easy. And I'll send Joab and I'll send all my friends and they can just take care of things for me. And this is good delegation, good leadership for me to stay back. Here's what was going on. David was being lazy instead of diligent. He's being lazy instead of diligent. He was sitting back, and so as he does in the springtime, this happened in Jerusalem just like it happens in New Jersey. It happened late one afternoon that David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. Now, listen, in the wintertime, you wouldn't see the same picture, but in the springtime, you'd begin to see some of this picture going on here. And so, and the woman was very beautiful, and David sent and inquired about the woman. And the one said, is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And notice they're saying she's a married woman. She's married to Uriah the Hittite. You know Uriah? Uriah is one of your key men here. And so David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now, she had been purifying herself from uncleanness. I'm not going to touch that one. Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, I am pregnant. This is where Jerry Springer's show would get really fascinating. The king sees this woman. She's good looking. Hey, go get her for me. She comes in. He says, yep. And so before long, she's pregnant. It only gets worse here. Because what David does in the following verses, once he realizes, oh, no, what was I thinking? I wasn't. And so she's pregnant, and now I've got to do something to cover up my sin. You'd never cover up your sin, right? Well, this is what King David does. King David tries to cover it up, so he calls and sends a letter and has Uriah come back from battle. I want you to come back, and I want you to take a little rest. So where is he going to take a rest? With his wife. What is the expectation? He'll follow through with marital duties, and so then he'll be off the hook because while it looks like King David, he's going to say, no, it's really your child. Well, Uriah is such an honorable man that what he does is he sleeps on the front steps, and he says, I'm not going in there while my men are out the battle. I mean, that's like major guilt that should be imposed on King David. So he sleeps on the front, and doesn't do anything. So then David realizes this isn't good. So here's what I'm going to do. If I just have him killed somehow, I'll do what King Saul did to me. King Saul put me in the position where I'd probably be killed in different ways. I mean, I'm going to make it a little harder for him. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put him on the front line and have everyone else pull back and see what he can do with the whole army. He thinks he's tough stuff. Let's see how tough he is. I mean, this would make Jerry Springer, yes? And so he does, and Uriah is killed. Fast forward through this whole picture, and you see David, finally he's exposed before Nathan the prophet, and just a really sad course of events. The child dies, and David weeps over the child, and all kinds of things. Verse 26, I just want to highlight verse 26. Because it's a summary, basically. The wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead. She lamented over her husband. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Good king, bad king. Ladies, how many of you would like to be his husband now? Here's the reality. The whole issue it started out with laziness. It all started out with him not being where he should be. I find as I work with different people, the struggle that we end up getting into is often comes, it often comes back to laziness. When I'm not where I should, when I am not where I should be, I often put myself into a position where I shouldn't be. For example, men, you're struggling with your wife, and you stay up later than you should. She goes to bed, and you stay up, and this may not be everyone. This might be some or a couple people, but here's what I've seen too many people say. They're struggling in their marriage, and so they stay up late, and they're looking at things and watching things that they have no business watching, and they put themselves in a position of failure, morally. Oftentimes, that's where it starts. Instead of being where your wife is, you kind of run out and, well, she's contentious, and so therefore I have this right. You know, I should be, this is the corner of my house stop. No, no, you don't have that right. You have no rights with Christ. He is the one that chooses, and you've just simply got to be available to do what he wants you to do and say, well, she's done. That's fine. Be Christ to her. And so we make all kinds of excuses, and or your spouse is in cleaning the dishes or doing laundry, and you're sitting there watching your third football game of the day and have done nothing to help her around the house. It's just laziness. It doesn't build a good house. It doesn't build a good marriage. What happens is your laziness gets the best of your marriage, and she looks, and it becomes a contention all over again. It's frustrating. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 6 says, go to the ant, you sluggard. Well, the ant doesn't need a king or queen to say, here's what your assignment is today. The ant just says, I need to do this. It's the right thing to do. Diligence is doing what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do it. Obedience is doing what you're told to do when you're told to do it. Diligence is doing what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do it. You, in your own mind and heart, know when you're supposed to be doing this, and so therefore you do it. When should you do your homework from school? Never's not the right answer here, yes? Last minute, I know, it's Thanksgiving weekend, and oh, I got all this homework to do this afternoon. Don't wait till 11 to get it started. That's not diligent. Do what when you're supposed to do. You know, so that's where diligence kind of plays itself in. And by the way, husbands and wives, this works out with you as well. Husbands, we often will give ourselves a bit more lazy time than we should, a bit more me time than we should. And I just want to pull us back and say, don't be lazy, be diligent. Be diligent. Don't put yourself in a position for failure. Put yourself in a position where you're taking care of and doing what God wants. Be available to God. That's the point. Now, I could go into this a lot further, and it's fascinating. By the way, Bathsheba, she is mother. Her second child, first one died. Second child is guess who? Solomon. It's the coolest thing. He's the next king. It shows God's grace in this whole situation. This displeased God, but God wasn't done yet. God pours out his grace in the situation. And from Bathsheba, Uriah the Hittites, wow, that's grace. Now, let's go to the next one, and we'll finish up here. 2 Samuel chapter 13. This gets even worse. This gets worse. And in chapter 13, we don't have really a lot of time to read through this whole passage. Feel free to do this later on. This would definitely, I actually think this is so bad, I don't know that Jerry Springer would allow this on a show. That's my opinion. This is chapter 13. Now Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, so we got siblings here, loved her. And Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister. He's tormented with lust, by the way. He's constantly thinking about, constantly lusting after her. And he makes himself sick. It says, she was a virgin. It seemed impossible for Amnon to do anything to her. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, which is interesting, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very crafty man. He said to him, O son of the king, why are you so haggard morning after morning? What's your problem? Why are you so depressed? Won't you tell me? Amnon said to him, I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister. Jonadab said, well, lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to you, say to him, let my sister Tamar come and give me bread to eat and prepare the food in my sight that I may see it and eat it from her hand. So he did that. Now, parents, wouldn't this look a little curious to you? Wouldn't you say, you want your sister to come feed you? I've got servants all over the place. Let me just take care of one of the servants. This would seem odd and peculiar, not a normal thing. But David just kind of goes with it. Whatever, just look, I don't have time for this. Send for Tamar, just do what he needs, and that's fine. So he does this, and that's the picture we get here. He does this, and as he does, she comes in to take care of him, and then he sends out all of the servants, and it's now just Tamar and Amnon. And he proceeds to rape her. The picture of rape that we have here, it's interesting. As you study out rape, the first thing she says is, I'm ashamed. It should be him that's ashamed, but oftentimes the victim within rape is the one that's ashamed. They don't want to tell anybody. They don't want anybody to know. They feel dirty, and they don't know what to do with it, and there's all kinds of physiological and emotional things that they have to work through at that point. This is a very amazing story to look, and I understand rape is something that is very current today, and statistically, there would be some women that may have experienced rape at some point in their life that are sitting here today. So here's how it works out. Absalom hears of this. And Absalom, Tamar's sister, says, I'm not going to have anything. I can't let this go. So here's where the sad part of this whole story is, and here's why I'm leading to where I'm leading. In verse 21, the person that should be doing something, the king should be concerned about justice and righteousness. That's what a king should be there for. In verse 21, when the king David heard of all these things, he was very angry. But Absalom spoke to Amnon. Listen, that's the end of it. He was emotionally affected by what happened in his home, and what did he do about it? He was simply angry. He was passive, not assertive. He was passive. I'm emotionally affected, and I know I should be doing something probably, but I'm just going to sit back and do nothing. To be passive is to simply sit back and say, oh, man, I'm so frustrated with, and then you don't do anything about it. I find as we walk with Christ, this is the temptation oftentimes, is to be passive when God is poking in and saying, you're not available here. You're not doing what you should be doing. You're at the wrong place at the wrong time. You shouldn't be here. We get passive a lot of times instead of being assertive in our lives, in the lives of others around us. God's called us to be assertive. It's not to be a bully and to push in where you shouldn't be. It's to be assertive in the situation that God would have you to be in. Very different. So as a father, his responsibility, and as a king, his responsibility, is to be assertive in this situation and make sure righteousness is dealt with here. And he does nothing. Verse 23, after 2 full years, Absalom had the sheep shears, and let me just give you the rest of the story without reading it. Absalom, after 2 years, takes matters into his own hand. And so he has this party set up where Amnon is there, and Amnon is drinking, and he's getting drunk and plastered, and Absalom comes in, and they didn't really talk to each other. They just kind of were coexisting apart from each other, and every now and again would see each other because they had to sometimes. So he's sitting down, he gets drunk at this party, and Absalom walks in and kills him. All the king's sons and the family just split. They're like, what is going on here? This is crazy. This shouldn't be happening. Absalom, at the end of this, knows that he's not welcome. And he doesn't even want to be a part of this kingdom. Why would you want to be a part of a kingdom that's not filled with righteousness? And he runs. And he goes and flees away from Jerusalem, away from David. David hears about this and basically he's like, well, Amnon's taken care of. That's fine. And now my son Absalom's away. And oh, this is so sad. Here's the point. James chapter 4, verse 17 says, whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. If you know the right thing that you should be doing, then do it. but I'm too tired. Okay, so what you're saying is, I'm going to be lazy instead of diligent. I'm not going to be available to do what God wants because I'm too tired. I'm making excuses. Yeah, but I don't feel like it. Okay, so you're choosing to be passive instead of assertive because your feelings are running you. Yeah, but what if somebody says this about, I don't. So you're choosing to neglect the responsibility that God's given to you because you're making excuses. This is where I find us a lot of times. Passive versus assertive. We should be assertive. We should be getting involved with what God has for us. He puts us in a position where we're not supposed to be gossiping. We're supposed to be dealing with truth. In the right timing as well. So we get involved in a situation that God's placed in our lap to be able to get involved in, and we make sure, and sometimes we say, I'm not sure that this is right, so then you work with someone else and say, I think I should be here. Help me understand. What should I be doing in this? And spend some time praying about it as well, especially when you're within your own home. Husbands, fathers, this is for us. We need to be diligent and assertive in our own homes to make sure that we're taking care of things to the best that we possibly can. We push. Don't be passive and saying, well, I don't know what to do and throw my hands up and I'll let my wife take care of it because she keeps criticizing me anyway. No. Be active. And be assertive and get involved. Now, let me conclude. This is such a mess, isn't it? I mean, would this be a Jerry Springer show that you'd maybe watch? I wouldn't. I mean, this is too much drama. They made this up. These are actors. I love how God puts real people into the Bible for us to glean from. These are messed up people. They're going through a messed up life. It's for us to grow from. And when you look at David, would you say he's a good king or bad king at this point? Would you want to follow this king? Oh, there he goes again. He's making the news. In Acts chapter 13, verse 22, God refers to David as a man after God's own heart. Why? Because within David's life, here's what he continued to do. When you look at Psalm chapter 51 and many others, you find that David, when he blows it, he says, I'm wrong. He doesn't blame shift and say somebody else did it. He says, it was me. I'm wrong. It's grace. He admitted his mistakes and he made the changes in his direction to follow after God. He recognized, I'm not available to God because I keep doing my thing. I'm filled with pride over here. I'm being lazy. I'm being passive. God, I'm wrong. I need to be where you want me to be. So God, forgive me. I'm making myself available to you. Here's the hope. If you've been giving toilet paper to God, God is so gracious that he forgives. If that's where you've been, you say, well, I've been giving God toilet paper and I should be giving him so much more. I should be giving him my first, the best. That's where I should be, and I keep giving everyone else the best and everything else the best. And God says, I forgive. So we come and we say, God, I'm wrong. Forgive me. Summary, our responsibility is simply being available to God. Our responsibility is simply being available to God. So can I ask you this question? Could you imagine what God could do in our homes and in this church if we stopped giving God and others toilet paper? How would that affect your home if you stop? No, don't nudge. Don't be thinking about the other person. Yeah, that'd be great if they would stop giving me toilet paper. No, this is you. How would your home change if you stopped giving God toilet paper in how you treat your spouse and your children or your parents? And you started giving God everything. Saying, okay, God, this is not a toilet paper moment. I'm not going to be a toilet paper gifter. God, I'm giving you everything. In Romans chapter 12, verse 1 and 2, Paul says, it is our reasonable service It is our reasonable service to give everything to God. It's just reasonable. He gave everything to us. It's reasonable for me to give everything back. Yeah, but you don't know my parents. Look at David. Was he a parent to follow? Yeah, but you don't know my spouse. Look at David. Was he a spouse to have? He wasn't that great of a catch at different times. Give God everything. Stop looking at other people and making excuses. Let's pray. Our Lord and Father, we thank you for your saving grace. Thank you for your forgiveness. Thank you for the amazing picture that you give to us of David, who he just had a rough time at different points. He failed trials. But Lord, the example and the legacy that he leaves is that he kept saying, I'm sorry. So Lord, help us to be that person that's willing to say, I'm wrong. Forgive us, God, where we've been doing what pleases us instead of what pleases you. Lord, lead us in the path of righteousness for your name's sake. It's in Jesus' name I pray.